I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 22 dead in Mosul. U.S. military officials are saying that yesterday's attack on a mess hall in Iraq may have been caused by a suicide bomb. Meantime, the wounded have arrived at a base in Germany for treatment. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is BBC reporter Caroline Hawley. Caroline, I understand there's an investigation underway?
That's right. The FBI is actually involved in the investigation, and I know that experts have been flown into Mosul. Now, as you know, originally officials had thought that it may be a rocket or mortar attack, but I spoke to a U.S. military spokesman up in Mosul who said they certainly couldn't rule out a suicide bombing. There has been a claim of responsibility for the attack by a group called Ansar al-Sunna. That's a group believed to be linked to al-Qaeda, and it said that it had carried out what it called a martyrdom operation, which is usually a reference to a suicide bombing. So they're still trying to determine the exact cause of the explosion as they begin to fly out the bodies of the dead and also the wounded, more than 70 wounded.
If it turns out to be a suicide bombing, that will mean they must have smuggled that in past some level of security on the outside of that base?
One would certainly imagine every U.S. base that I have ever been near to in Iraq has very strict security. So if it was a suicide bombing, it would have to have been by someone who infiltrated into the camp, someone maybe who was working there or someone who was able to get into the camp. It would be a pretty serious security breach.
Now, there were concrete barriers around that mess tent, but, of course, there was a canvas roof. What are military officials saying about what must have been a known security weakness there?
As you say, it was known, and safety concerns had been raised about it because there was no concrete cover. And I know that people who had eaten in that dining facility were worried. But actually, we're told, in the process of building now a covered place where people can eat their meals, but that is still being prepared. But it's certainly not the first time that mortars or rockets have been fired at that particular base.
Have you talked to U.S. soldiers in Baghdad today about this? An attack like this really strikes soldiers at perhaps the one place that they could relax and feel a little bit safe.
I've actually spoken to a U.S. military spokesman in Mosul, who acknowledges that they are facing what he calls a tough situation up there. He said the insurgents had been very successful, and it's not just yesterday's attack. There has been trouble brewing in Mosul for some time. In fact, as you may know, as the offensive on Fallujah was taking place, insurgents in Mosul were overrunning police stations, and the police force essentially collapsed. So the Americans have been facing a difficult situation up there in Mosul for some time.
Immediately after the war, Mosul and the surrounding area in northern Iraq seemed to be one of the quieter, more stable parts of the country. That's been changing in recent months. What seems to be going on in that region?
Well, it's a good question. It was certainly hailed as a success story for the U.S. military in the few months after the war. But I think it was always known that there were some loyalists of Saddam Hussein up in that area, some members of the former regime who had lost a lot since the regime was toppled. And as you know, Uday and Qusay, Saddam Hussein's two sons, were killed there last summer. Mm-hmm. But it does seem as if over the most recent weeks and months, insurgents have begun to use Mosul as a base, and American and Iraqi officials have expressed concern that followers of the Jordanian militant Abu Musab Zarqawi have been basing themselves in Mosul. And certainly the taking over of police stations last month was a very, very serious concern because, as you know, standing up a strong Iraqi security force is the exit strategy of the Americans, and that exit strategy in Mosul is in ruins now.
How else have U.S. officials responded to the attack? There's a curfew, I understand.
That's right. I mean, as you can imagine, U.S. military officials in Mosul are shocked. This was the deadliest attack on the Americans since the end of the war. They are stepping up security. They have announced that there is a curfew. That has been announced on loudspeakers and also on radio stations. Now they are carrying out security sweeps. They have also blocked bridges. So they are doing what they can, but a U.S. military official did acknowledge that the situation there was extremely tense.
Caroline Hawley of the BBC in Baghdad, thank you.
Thanks a lot, then.
This year, as families come together to celebrate the holidays, many will realize for the first time that their aging parents can no longer live on their own without some sort of help. In fact, by one estimate, more than 30 million working Americans are helping to care for their aging parents, and elder care now rivals child care as the number one concern of America's workforce. Joining us now is Lois Von Halle. She helps care for her mother and her father-in-law. They're both 89 years old and both live in Los Angeles, which is a long way from where Lois lives in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
What does this involve for you, taking care of your mother and your father-in-law, both of them hundreds of miles from where you live?
Mostly I just do supportive care because I have a sister-in-law who checks in on my father-in-law, and my sister has moved into my mother's home with her. But because I'm curious about the healthcare field and have been involved, I know some resources, and I worry a lot about them.
So they're both living independently?
Yes.
And are you making a lot of trips out to L.A.?
Yes, we have gone on an average of every other month. For periods, we were going every month.
Time on the phone and so on.
Oh, we talk every night to both of them.
Yeah. And I know you have responsibilities at home as well. Your husband isn't well and has advanced MS. What
yes.
kind of toll does this take on you?
I have to walk a tightrope on emotions. My husband is very good in the fact that he is supportive and wants to be able to go to Los Angeles. That is the big thing. He at one point said, no more trips. And so we stopped going for about 4 months, and that was very difficult because I miss seeing them. I worry about both parents. And so that was just very, very hard. It made me very sad and very kind of depressed when he said no more trips.
What do you mean walk a tightrope? Between doing too much and feeling like you're not doing enough? What do you mean?
It's really walking a tightrope of emotions. So I do keep very busy to not spend too much time thinking about everything that's going on. But because if I spend too much time thinking about it, then I can get depressed easily.
Let's bring someone else in here. Angelique Von Halle, your daughter, has been listening. Angelique is an RN, a registered nurse, and she joins us from San Francisco. Angelique, hi.
Hi.
What do you think about what your mom is taking on?
I always think that she's taking on too much. I mean, my father's very, very debilitated. He cannot move by himself at all, can't feed himself, can't get up. And so my mom manages his care, in addition to being a huge support for my grandparents.
Yeah.
And so I really worry about her own health because she tends to be fourth on the list of people to look out for.
There are some statistics that actually show that caregivers have higher mortality rates than the people they're caring for.
Yeah, we're well aware of that. Actually, my mom's made us aware of that through her own connection to the caregiving community.
I've lost friends that were caregivers before their care recipients have died, and it makes me very aware. And that when I said a tightrope before, I'm aware of it, and I try to be careful, but my children keep me in tow and remind me.
That's good that they do that. This situation does put strains on a family, though.
Yes. I worry a lot about my children because I know that they're watching. And I know that they worry about their father and their mother. I don't think they want to lose either one of us, but I think it would be quite an insult if they lost me first because my husband is so debilitated and I don't appear to be at all.
Angelique, you're the oldest of three. Does this whole situation introduce tensions between you and your siblings?
I'd say in some ways, yeah, because there can be expectations that someone's not doing their part. None of us is hugely financially successful. And so we all try and do our part how we can, but it never feels like enough. We do wish that we could contribute more, both financially and time-wise. And we do our best to provide emotional support. But I think the crisis has brought us closer.
Sure. What kind of things is it that your mom does that concern you?
Oh, she'll go to Los Angeles without a whole lot of planning and forget key things like the charger for my father's electric wheelchair or the mechanized tool to help move him from a chair to a bed or medicines or something like that. Because she can be juggling so many things, have so many plates in the air at one time, one of them doesn't make it.
Lois, you're making your daughter worried.
And it troubles me. That is my biggest worry, because I know I don't have control over the health of any of the three people who I worry about, but my children should have long lives, and when I make them worry, it concerns me.
And on top of all this, Lois, you're now adding something else. You're reaching out to others in your community who are in your position. Tell me about that.
It's the best thing that happens for me, because when I look at my husband and deal with my husband, he is the person that I married a long time ago. And even though he can't move, when he can communicate to me, my friendship is still there with him. So I don't look at us as being in a disabling or different lifestyle. I just do what has to be done on a daily basis, and there's a lot of hands-on. When I work with people and help people and they tell me their stories, it helps me visit the grief that really does exist in my life. The losses that I've had in not being able to do things like normal people, normal lovers, actually. You know, my husband can't put his arm around me and hug me. I can hug him and make believe that that's comforting. But those are things I don't think about them in our daily lives, but when people tell me stories, then I experience it and I cry with them. And that helps me do grief work, so that, and you asked before, the tightrope that I live, I'm always aware that what kills people is not dealing with the grief. And grief is a horrendous measure. It takes a toll on people. And if you don't know how to deal with it, then it takes hold of your body and just kills you.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us today and for your precious time today.
Thank you very much.
And Angelique, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, situations like the one facing the Van Halas are not just causing stress on families. They're beginning to take a toll on corporate America. When we come back, we'll find out how the business community is responding to elder care issues. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. We're talking about the growing need for elder care in America. Taking care of an aging parent can be a full-time job, even for people who are already working. And by one estimate, those conflicting demands cost American businesses upwards of $30 billion a year. Some companies are beginning to provide services to help their employees cope, and with me in the studio is Diane Pictialis, an elder care expert with the Ceridian Corporation in Boston. Hi, welcome.
Nice to be here, Alan.
Dan, we just heard from Lois Van Halen and her daughter Angelique about their experience taking care of family members. How common are those stresses that they're under?
They're very common, Alan. Elder care is an area that people don't anticipate having to deal with. They don't plan for it. And there's a lot of emotional involvement around a parent growing older and losing their independence. So studies have shown that elder caregivers are very, very stressed.
And you know this as someone who works in the field, but also from personal experience.
Yes, I do. I have a 93-year-old mother who 2 years ago began to have the signs of early dementia, and I actually work a four-day week and take Fridays and drive across the state to spend the day with my mother and help get things together for her. And so I'm living it firsthand.
What kind of strains does having an elderly parent in the family put on siblings, for instance?
Family dynamics play a very large role in elder care. for a number of reasons, is oftentimes siblings have very different kinds of relationships, not just with a parent, but with each other. They may have very different ideas about what's good for mom. For example, one sibling may say, look, she's old, just leave her alone and just let nature take its course. Another sibling may say, well, that's crazy. If you provide her supportive services or put her in assisted living, she could have 5 or 10 more good years. You also get into arguments and fights about whether mom should go to be closer to, you know, sibling A in Colorado or sibling B in Ohio. And all of these kinds of dynamics really feed into making it a very complicated thing.
And, of course, the financial pressure doesn't help anything.
That's true. Research shows that caregivers spend on average about $20,000 a year. That's a low estimate. The average cost of a nursing home in this country is $60,000, and of assisted living is about $40,000 to $45,000. So the cost is really significant. The other cost that people don't often think about is the cost long-term to the caregiver. Brandeis University did a study that was funded by Metropolitan Life called The Juggling Act, and it basically quantified the cost to an individual in terms of lost retirement income because they had to cut back work, lost pay, et cetera, was about $659,000 over the lifetime to a caregiver.
Wow. Well, I see at least one statistic that says about 1 in 4 large companies are now providing some help for their employees who are in the situation. But in general, how well do you think the working world is responding to the growing need?
I think it's responding more and more. It's an interesting statistic, the 1 in 4. One would say that that's a very good response rate for large companies, and it is. We actually work with hundreds of companies that have decided to provide these services for employees. I think where it gets a little scarcer is in small employers. Mm-hmm. The Society for Human Resource Management did a study earlier this year, and they found that only about 15% of small companies offer elder care support. So it tends to be the leaders in benefits.
Now, your company, Ceridian Corporation, is providing a number of things to companies that contract your services. You're helping employees identify services in their area, providing one-on-one counseling. When companies do provide elder care services, are they doing that out of altruism, for the benefit of their employees? Or are they doing it because it helps the bottom line?
They're definitely doing it because it helps the bottom line, and it also helps retain and get the commitment of those employees. But essentially, it is a bottom line issue. The amount of lost productivity you mentioned earlier was upwards of $30 billion. If you really look at the life of a caregiver, what happens when they're involved in elder care is they spend enormous amounts of time on the phone trying to find services and make arrangements. They might come in late or leave early. They have unplanned absences. You know, mom gets sick and they say, I'm sorry, I'm on the next plane. I'm going to Tampa and I don't know exactly when I'll be back. So it's that kind of impact. And I think the more subtle part, which employers have begun to realize, is that somebody who is really worried about a parent is very distracted. They're not focused on work. It's what we call in the human resources business, presenteeism. You're physically there, but you're not really there to be productive.
And what are the variables about why companies sometimes are able to offer this or decide to offer it and others don't?
Oftentimes, companies that use our services, a CEO or somebody else in senior management all of a sudden has been confronted with elder care, and they realize even for them how difficult this is, and they say, we need to do something about this to help our employees.
If people don't have help from the employer, where can they turn?
They can turn to the public sector. They could call the Administration on Aging in Washington, D.C., which could connect them with state and local agencies. That would be in areas where their older relative might live. For example, one of the big complications of elder care is often the older person lives at a great distance.
Mm-hmm.
We're a very mobile society, and people move around. Sometimes it's not just the children. It's the older person. They retired. They leave New York
down
and go to
Florida. As our population ages, I wonder if we'll begin to think about elder care services differently.
Well, I think we have to. And I think that one of the problems is we don't think about elder care services at all. It's a very invisible problem. It's one that we deny. We're an ageist society. We really focus on youth. We value youth. I mean, how many times have you heard somebody at a cocktail party say, "My mom, she's in great shape. She's going to outlive us all." The fact is, she isn't, but right. We want to deny that, and we deny it till the very bitter end.
Diane Pictialis, an elder care expert with Ceridian Corporation in Boston. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, people believe that the Virgin Mary had to give birth to Jesus in a stable because she wasn't welcome at the local inn. All wrong, says a biblical scholar. Tomorrow, what the Bible really says about the birth of Jesus. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 25 years ago this week, the Soviet Union launched its ill-fated invasion of Afghanistan. A quarter century later, it's U.S. soldiers fighting in the hills of that country, and the Soviet Union is no more. But Russia has not retreated from the news, and after a disputed election in Ukraine and the recent breakup of the oil giant Yukos, U.S.-Russian tensions are again on the increase. Marshall Goldman is a Russian scholar at Harvard University and Wellesley College and the author of The Piratization of Russia. I asked him if Afghanistan led to the Soviet Union's undoing.
It certainly was an important factor in ultimately weakening the Soviet Union. Remember, this 1980, this was the middle of the Cold War, superpower status, and we were worried at any minute that the Soviet Union would destroy us or we would destroy them. And what it showed, to everyone's surprise, that this backward country, Afghanistan, was able to mobilize in such a way as to defeat the vaunted Soviet army, which was just across the border. It wasn't as if they had to go across an ocean. It was on their border. And so this led to a crisis of confidence and a demoralization, if you will, of the troops and of the population. And ultimately, it was a factor in weakening the country.
Well, there's so much going on now in Russia, it's hard to know exactly where to start. But let's begin with the breakup of the Russian oil and gas giant Yukos, a private company. Russia's the world's second largest producer of oil. This was, I think, their biggest oil company. And now it's been broken up because of what seems to be a sort of personal vendetta. Is that going too far?
Your statement's not going too far. The Russians going too far, for sure. Here was this company that was had really kind of turned the corner. It was becoming transparent. They were producing on the order, this particular unit, a million barrels a day.
And this is a company owned by Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Yeah, Khodorkovsky.
Who made an enemy of Putin.
That's right. Yukos, that was the name of the company. They took off the most productive section of it, and they auctioned it off for what they call the failure to pay taxes. Now, there's no doubt that Yukos did not pay its full tax bill before, but there's hardly any company in Russia that did. So he picked on this company. The tax bill kept escalating until it reached the point where, as of last week anyway, it was $27 billion. That amounted to more in various years than the total revenue. So this was clearly kind of a stage situation.
Now, the oil and gas division of Yukos is sold for $9.3 billion to a previously unknown company. And the initial reporting was that this company had as its address a convenience store 100 miles north of Moscow. What do we know about this company?
Well, we've learned a little bit more about it. The company is called Baikal, named after the lake, Baikal Finance Group. It seems to be an offshoot of another oil company, Sorgut Neftegas. So it looks like it's a front for that.
What is all this going to do to investor confidence in Russia and hence to the Russian economy?
Well, it's had an enormous impact on investor confidence. You know, investors tend to be very narrow-sighted. They see something, we've got a chance here. I mean, I have been a perennial pessimist about this, and the investors will say, look, if we followed your advice, we wouldn't have made as much money as we have, and the Russian, you know, it's the market, and it'll work out. Now, of course, what has happened is some of them have been very badly hurt. The value of Yuko stock, which was the major vehicle for most American and Western investors, is basically zero because it's bankrupt. If that were all, maybe people wouldn't be quite so pessimistic or so upset now. But there have been a series of other instances in the last few weeks where another telecommunications company has just been given a very big tax bill, and it could lead to the same kind of situation. So investors are upset. And given this uncertainty and this confusion, the oil companies have stopped drilling new wells. And so oil production, while it's still increasing, is now beginning to increase at a slower rate. And Yukos actually says it's dropped.
So turns out Vladimir Putin is bad for capitalism. I don't know if we should be surprised or not, but what's he doing?
It's almost like he's a masochist. He's hurting himself. But he, you know, he's bad for capitalism, yet he espouses capitalism. Mm-hmm. He's bad for democracy, but he espouses democracy. I think what he sees is, I like the notion, I like the facade, but what goes on underneath and the, you know, the making of the sausage, as it were, the making of democracy, the making of the market, he doesn't like. And so he really crushes it. And this is causing a real crisis of confidence from the outside. And people are saying to President Bush, why don't you be more critical of him because of what he's doing?
Have economic and political reforms essentially stopped now under Putin?
Well, they seem to have. I mean, the state has regained control of all the major television networks. Putin has just announced in September that he's doing away with elections of the governors. He will appoint the governors from now on, although they'll have to be in a pro forma approved by local assemblies. But he will pick them. He's doing the same thing to the election for the Duma. So that stopped. And so it really seems like a massive step to the rear.
And Freedom House, a U.S. organization that tracks civil freedoms around the world, downgraded Russia this week for the first time since 1991 from partly free to not free at all. Then we have what's going on in Ukraine. Is Putin trying to reassert some sort of regional authority by meddling in the Ukraine election?
Well, he's, you know, Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and it's a Slavic nation, and that Ukraine and Russia have been very close. The Slavs really kind of originate from Kiev, which has then caused some ambiguity for Russians who say, well, you know, we start in Kiev. It's now Ukraine. We've got to have passports to get into the country. What's going on? So, but Putin is saying we want to try to make sure that our neighbors, what they call the near abroad, are friendly, and we want to intervene. But politically, the political process is really being destroyed. One of my friends is still in the Duma, a liberal Democrat. And what has happened, because he's been critical of everything, of Ukraine, of Putin, of all, they're trying to destroy him. And so they launched a campaign way before the election to try to show that he's a supporter of the Chechens. And they have put up posters showing him in the middle of the two extreme leaders of Chechnya. And it's, you know, it's kind of undoing of the whole democratic process.
As recently as Monday, President Bush was citing his what he called good personal relationship with Putin.
With Vladimir.
With Vladimir. What should we be looking for? The two men are supposed to meet in February. What should we be looking for in terms of relations between the United States and Russia?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if President Bush doesn't exercise a firmer hand and is more critical. Yesterday, Putin and Schroeder met. And Schroeder, you know, again, was in that same mode. Well, we don't want to do anything to disrupt this relationship. They all claim they've got a very close relationship, and they want to sustain it because in the long run they think they can get something more. We'll talk outside the realm of the cameras and the radio about what's going on, and we'll try to exercise pressure there. It'll be interesting to see if they do, if President Bush does, if Condoleezza Rice does, and if Putin backs away from these things. I'm skeptical, however.
We shall see. Thank you for being here.
Sure. Well, thank you for letting me come.
Professor Marshall Goldman at Harvard University and Wellesley College is the author of The Piratization of Russia. You're listening to Here and Now. By now, most people who celebrate Christmas have probably already erected and decorated their Christmas trees. But some trees remain in parking lots across the country. Mark Brush of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium recently spent some time with one tree grower in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
It's a crisp afternoon at this Christmas tree lot. That generator you hear is powering the electric saws. The guys trim up the base of the tree so it'll fit on a tree stand. Their hands are all blackened with sap and dirt from wrestling hundreds of trees off of the flatbed truck. They take the bundled trees, open them up, and stick them onto stands. They've created a makeshift forest in the middle of this strip mall parking lot. Customers wander through the forest, searching for the perfect tree.
I'm going to put you in the hands of Ben right here. He's going for salesman of the day. He's got a long way to go.
Duke Wagatha runs this tree lot in southeastern Michigan. He appears with his trees each year from his farm up north.
We get here the weekend before Thanksgiving. It takes us probably about a week or 5 days to set up, and with the idea of opening the day after Thanksgiving, we like to let folks get one holiday out of the way, and then we start on the next.
He calls his business Flat Snoots Trees. You couldn't tell from looking at his face now, but he calls it Flat Snoots to make light of a broken nose he suffered in high school. Duke's coveralls are all tarnished with pine needles and sap, and when he moves, you hear ringing from the bells on his hat. He moves between the trees in his parking lot forest, telling his customers jokes and filling their heads with visions of Scotch pine, Fraser firs, and blue spruce. Margaret Yanka has been buying trees from Duke for more than 6 years.
He just makes it really personable. And there was one year it was really kind of warm. He had his Hawaiian shirt on and his straw hat, and he was out here partying away, and I'm like, whoa, you know, but it's fun to come just to run and, you know, talk to him, and they're really helpful.
While they're away from home, Duke and his crew live in a 1950s vintage trailer. The trailer's paint is faded, but Duke spruces it up for the holidays with wreaths and pine boughs. And when you step inside, the old lamps and rustic furniture make it seem as if you've stepped back in time.
Ooh, this feels better here, doesn't it? I need a good excuse to get in here.
The trailer also doubles as his office. Customers pay for their trees in here, and on occasion, they'll have a complimentary nip of what Duke calls his bad schnapps. Duke is from Miesick, a small rural town in northern Michigan. Christmas tree farming is big business in Michigan. The state is second only to Oregon in the number of acres that are in Christmas tree production. Duke calls himself a small-time grower. He's a carpenter by trade, but his work tends to dry up in the long winter months.
It's not enough to make a living for me and my family year-round, but it's a good extra source of income. And winters are tough up there, so if you make a little bit extra money, winters are tough and expensive. Living in the country, you know, like anybody, you got propane bills and all that, and it's a little colder up there. So to make a little bit of money going into winter is pretty nice.
A lot of work went into growing the trees that are now on his lot. Each summer, workers plod through the rows and rows of trees, swinging razor-sharp machetes. They trim each tree to give them that classic, symmetrical Christmas tree shape. And after about 10 years, the trees are ready for harvest. And they're loaded onto trucks and shipped down to the lots.
Forever, you could make this your St. Paddy's Day tree.
Even though there's a jovial atmosphere on the lot, there's also a sense of urgency. After all, Duke only has a few weeks to sell trees that in many cases have taken more than 10 years to grow.
We've got Scotch pine over there, Scotch pine here. We've got a few more Scotch pine here now.
And while selling the trees is an important part of Duke's income, he gets something else out of it. He enjoys making connections with the people who wander through his tree lot.
Sometimes you get some grumpy folks coming in, and it's usually just because they're overwhelmed with shopping. It's cold out. They didn't wear the long under, whatever. But we can usually get them turned around. You know, we have a little fun with them, you know. And like I say, if we got to bring them to the trailer and have a shot of bad schnapps with them, hey, that's fine, too.
It's closing time at the tree lot. Right now, Duke's trailer is filled with his extended family and friends.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Matter of fact,
my name
is
Duke. Will continue to sell his trees right up until Christmas Eve. Then he'll drive back home to spend a few days with his family before he comes back to tear the lot down.
It's kind of like the circus coming to town. You build up your tree lot. You almost build, like, well, I wouldn't say a village, but a little spot where there was nothing, just, you know, an asphalt parking lot. And when we leave, there's nothing left. We sweep her up and go. So, it's, you know, it's almost like a mirage. Were those guys really here? Yeah, they were.
And so they spring to their trucks and drive out of sight, knowing they've helped make the season merry night after night.
That report by Mark Brush of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. Updating our top story in Mosul, Iraq, Bill Nemitz of the Portland Press Herald is there. Bill, where were you yesterday when the attack happened?
Alan, I was in my barracks, which is a short distance down the hill from the dining facility. We were, in fact, preparing to go to lunch. I was putting some of my shoes on and sitting in a chair when the blast hit. Even from that distance, it lifted me out of my chair. We ran up and saw what you can imagine was a very horrific scene up there.
A horrific scene, as we've heard. What's the situation today?
Things are very somber around here, I would say, although I must say the soldiers are going about their work. This is an engineer battalion. They have a lot of work to do, and I think it's kind of therapeutic for them to be doing it. But on the other hand, I think it's the real impact of what happened is just beginning to sink in, and you're starting to see people work their way through that denial stage and start to confront their grief.
Any word on whether it was a suicide bombing or a mortar attack?
There's a lot of speculation about that right now. There's been no confirmation from Task Force Olympia as to exactly what it was. I spoke to General Carter Hamm about that last night, and he said they're not ruling out anything at this point. You can listen to one story and think it was a rocket. You think you're listening to another story, and it sounds like a suicide bomber. I think we'll just have to wait for the forensic people to do their work before we know what exactly it was.
And very quickly, the situation in Mosul Center.
We're hearing a lot of small arms fire and other noise coming out of there right now, which is consistent with reports that we got that there's a rather significant military sweep going on. We're on a hill overlooking the city, and as I said, you can hear a lot of noise coming out of there right now.
Thanks, Bill. Bill Nemitz of the Portland Press Herald. For many of us, the best part of the holidays is the chance to curl up with one or two good books. Here at Now's Bill Marks recently talked year-end reading with our book reviewer Steve Almond. Steve says books are his way of escaping from the stress of family during the holidays.
My general holiday plans are you have to erect some kind of barrier, and it's very rude just to say, I just honestly can't spend any more time with you because I don't have enough money for the ensuing therapy, so what I like to do is just use the book as a productive weapon. I'll just say, you know, I'm in the middle of this great book, and I'm just going to go read. And it's magical. People, there's such moral gravity to reading that people will leave you alone.
I think that sounds great. I myself would like to use books as a sort of weapon where I can throw them at relatives.
Right. Well, that comes if step one doesn't work.
They're not in the moral suasion. You know, my relatives are a little more primitive. Now, everyone's coming out with their own best list. There are a whole bunch of them. I mean, they're just – I think they're actually too many. I mean, you know, you could make up a list of hundreds of best lists. But yours seem pretty short, so I like that. So what's one of the books on your list?
Well, the first book I want to recommend people get for the holidays is a new novel from Margot Livesey, who's one of my favorite writers, and it's called Banishing Verona. This is her fifth novel. It's got a very inventive plot that keeps you reading to find out what's going to happen next, but the genius of her writing is that she so deeply connects with her characters, and the reader is left wondering, and this is a love story, basically, between two fairly unconventional figures, a woman who's 7 months pregnant, whose name is Verona, who meets a young house painter from London named Zeke, who's, you know, 29 years old and has real autistic-like problems relating to people. And they have a one-night stand and fall in love. Happens all the time, right? And then she disappears off the face of the earth, apparently, and the rest of the book is consumed with his trying to find her. I'm just going to read a little section of it that's their initial meeting. "Hi," he said, hating the single stupid syllable. She was tall for a woman, his height save for the step, and dimly familiar, though not as herself. As she began to speak, he realized who she reminded him of, the bust of Beethoven on his father's piano, something about the expansiveness of her features, the way her tawny hair sprang back from her forehead. I love that.
That's
how many times do you get a character, the romantic lead, who as a woman and reminds you of Beethoven? That might be a first in American letters.
That could really be a unique romance.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. It's such an unlikely romance. It's so not Hollywood.
But it's also a culture clash in the book as well, to the extent that he's in London and then he comes to America. And this is also the author who is not originally from America, sort of investigating what it's like to come from elsewhere here.
Yeah, absolutely. And also doing it through the eyes of a character who, just because of his the way he processes information, has to examine the world so much more carefully than the standard standard narrator.
Now, this book has been adored by a number of critics, and you brought in another book that has also been admired by a lot of critics.
Well, the second book I want to talk about is a book that I read it twice. It's Philip Roth's new book, The Plot Against America. People might be familiar with the actual plot of the book, which is basically that in 1940, rather than electing FDR, as actually happened in history, as an isolationist candidate, a candidate against World War II, the Republicans nominate Charles Lindbergh, and he's actually elected president, running on an anti-war platform. And gradually and insidiously, he makes an alliance with Hitler and ominous, clear, sort of insidiously anti-Semitic policies begin to be adopted by the administration. That makes it sound awfully political, but it's really a book about family and how family is torn apart by politics. It's something like, I think the closest cognate I could think of is The Grapes of Wrath. That is, there's a political subtext to that book, but it's really about family.
Part of the popularity of the book is, you know, due to the controversy over its politics. The left wing sees it as being about George Bush, while the right views it as an indictment of Kerry, sort of a replay of today's culture wars set back in World War II. What do you make of that?
Well, it's about a family, and it's about the sort of insidiousness of a fascistic mindset in culture. I mean, imagine a kid in today's culture whose dad is Bushy and whose mom is a lefty. And imagine, an older brother who goes one way or the other, and how really traumatized a 9-year-old kid might be trying to figure out who's right about the world. And seeing all that anger and acrimony, that's the genius of the novel. It's about Newark, his home turf, and it's a kind of impassioned love letter to the potentialities of family and being a good citizen in the United States. It's deeply moving. I can't recommend the book highly enough.
Since you're talking about a good citizenship, let's turn to political books. Of course, given the election and all that's going on, I mean, we've had a flood of books on politics on both sides. Many of them are being pulped as we speak. I mean, I doubt that people are going to be running out to read Kerry's various books on him or by him. Now, what are some books that you think will stick? In other words, books that came out during this period that are worth reading now.
Well, I think one book that will stick is the 9/11 Commission Report. It took a lot of money to produce, but it was really it's a fascinating document. They decided to write it really well. That is, they didn't make it bureaucraties, and people were deeply fascinated by the intricacies of how this great tragedy happened, and I think the report does a great job of answering that very briskly in a narrative form. I think people will continue to look back to that long after the rancor of this particular election season is sort of a footnote.
All right. Now, I'm going to take this opportunity to rush in a few of my suggestions before we get shut down. In terms of fiction, Heir to the Glimmering World, which is a new novel by Cynthia Ozick. This is a gorgeously written book. I mean, sentence by sentence, she's one of the best we've got. For nonfiction, let me just say there's a book called Pleasure in the Arts, Enjoying Literature, Painting, and Music. We're inundated with books by Harold Bloom and other windbags telling us that we have to read for wisdom. Why read? We have to read to become better people, to become more philosophically adept and whatever. Here's a book which I think is fairly well written, which says you read to enjoy. You have to start with pleasure and enjoyment. All the rest is important, but if you don't want to go to a book to be lost and just curl up and feel something different, then why bother to read?
Yes, it's even better than the motive of escaping your family is that you would escape into a book that you really love.
Here and Now, Steve Almond and Bill Marks. You can check their picks on our website, here-now.org. And we should mention that Steve Almond wrote his own best-selling book this year. It's Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Thanks today to the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, a production of Michigan Public Radio. Support comes from the George Gunn Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can learn more about the Great Lakes Radio Consortium at glrc.org. I'm Ellen Cockle. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Alan.